Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really complex issue with you, drug legalization in the United States. You've shared a fascinating range of materials, including a detailed ethics lecture. And our goal is to extract the core arguments and the very different perspectives on this, spanning from marijuana to what are often called hard drugs.
Absolutely. You've given us a lot to unpack, and it's clear from the outset that there are no easy answers here. We need to understand the history that, led us to this point and then really dig into the ethical, economic, and societal considerations on both sides of this debate.
Okay, let's start by laying some historical groundwork. Our sources remind us that the war on drugs became a major federal initiative under President Nixon back in 1969.
You're right.
Then you had President Reagan establishing the Office of National Drug Control Policy in 88. And President Clinton even elevated the head of that office, the drug czar, to a cabinet-level position in 93. Yeah, so this shows a sustained high-level commitment to combating drug use through, significant federal spending on things like border control and, public awareness campaigns.
And the sheer scale of that effort is quite remarkable when you look at the numbers. The data you provided from 2015 is really telling. Around 1.5 million drug arrests in that single year.
1.5 million.
Yeah, with about a third of those individuals ultimately incarcerated. What's also notable is that roughly 40% of those arrests were for marijuana-related offenses.
40%, just for marijuana.
Right.
And by 2016, the number of drug offenders in U.S. prisons was around 450,000 out of a total incarcerated population of about 2.2 million. That's a substantial portion.
It really is.
Now, if we fast forward to 2020, we see a pretty significant shift happening, at least concerning marijuana. Recreational use had been legalized in, a dozen states? That's Alaska, California, Colorado, Illinois, Maine, Massachusetts, Michigan, Nevada, Oregon, Vermont, Washington, and also Washington, D.C. Mm. And medical use was legal in another 23 states.
So this evolving legal landscape around marijuana really sets the stage for the much more intense debate when we talk about legalizing what are often termed hard drugs, things like amphetamines,
stimulants,
narcotics like opioids and hallucinogens such as psilocybin and LSD, the psychedelics that alter perception. This is where the arguments become particularly complex and divergent.
Exactly. So let's dive into the arguments for taking that significant next step. And one of the first and most prominent voices you encounter is that of the economist Milton Friedman. He had some pretty firm beliefs on this.
Yeah, Friedman.
One of his central arguments was that legalization would actually lead to a decrease in narcoterrorism by essentially dismantling the economic engine of the black market. Make these substances legal and regulated, and suddenly the illegal drug cartels lose their immense power and, the vast profits that fuel them.
What's fascinating here is that the direct connection Friedman makes between the prohibition of drugs and the thriving of violent criminal organizations. His logic is that by removing the illegal status, you eliminate the primary financial incentive for these groups to exist and operate with such impunity.
Mm.
It raises the question, though, are there historical examples where legalizing a previously illicit substance has demonstrably reduced related violence?
That's a great point to consider. He also argued, somewhat counterintuitively, that legalization might actually lead to a reduction in overall drug use because it would remove the forbidden fruit effect. The idea is that when something is illegal and taboo, it can actually become more alluring to certain people, make it legal and commonplace, and that inherent attraction might, diminish.
That's an interesting psychological angle. It suggests that the very act of prohibition can inadvertently increase the desirability of a substance for some individuals. It certainly challenges the more straightforward assumption that greater availability invariably leads to greater consumption.
And Friedman wasn't finished there. He also strongly believed that legalization would significantly decrease drug-associated crimes like theft and murder simply because the cost of these drugs would plummet.
Right.
If users could obtain these substances legally and at a much lower price, the desperation that drives some to commit crimes to finance their habit would be greatly reduced.
Right. If drugs are legally produced and sold under a regulated system, the price would likely drop considerably, effectively undercutting the black market and, in theory, reducing the need for users to resort to criminal activity to afford them.
But
however, we also need to consider the potential for addiction to still drive some individuals to desperate acts, even if the initial cost is lower.
That's a fair point. And finally, a major point, especially for taxpayers. Friedman argued that ending the war on drugs would result in massive financial savings for the government, billions of dollars currently being spent on law enforcement, interdiction efforts, and the incarceration of drug offenders.
These are certainly compelling economic arguments that focus on dismantling the infrastructure of the illegal drug trade and reallocating those substantial resources to other areas. However, as you pointed out earlier, there are very strong counterarguments to these claims.
Oh, definitely.
And the perspective of William Bennett, the former drug czar, provides a robust opposition.
Exactly. Bennett raises the concern of a likely significant increase in drug abuse if legalization were to occur across the board. He often points to the repeal of alcohol prohibition in the United States.
Right, that example.
And the subsequent substantial jump in alcohol consumption, what was it, 350%, as a historical parallel, suggesting that we could see a similar or maybe even greater surge in drug use if they were legalized.
Yeah, the analogy to alcohol prohibition is a frequently cited one in this debate. It highlights the potential for increased accessibility to lead to a greater overall prevalence of use and, consequently, potentially more cases of addiction and related health issues.
Bennett also argues that legalization wouldn't actually eliminate the illegal underground market.
Why not?
His reasoning is that governments would almost certainly impose significant taxes on legal drugs, much like they do with tobacco and alcohol.
Oh, okay.
And this would create a strong economic incentive for black market operators to continue producing and selling untaxed drugs at a lower price.
This is a really critical point to consider. If legally sold drugs are priced high due to taxation, it could very well allow a cheaper, unregulated black market to persist, thereby undermining one of the primary goals of legalization, to eliminate the illegal trade.
Exactly.
We see something similar with the black market for tobacco in some areas, with high cigarette taxes, right?
Yeah, precisely. And he doesn't believe that drug-related crimes would simply vanish either. Bennett argues that even with legalization, the potentially high cost of particularly addictive drugs like crystal meth and opioids could still drive desperate users to theft and violence to finance their habit.
Even if it's legal.
If they couldn't afford the legal taxed alternatives, yeah.
Okay, I see. The core of this argument is that the nature of addiction can sometimes override rational economic behavior. Even if drugs are legally available, the intense cravings and the potential high cost of maintaining a severe addiction could still lead individuals to engage in criminal activity.
Right. Finally, Bennett challenges the idea of major financial gains from legalization. He suggests that while the costs associated with, say, drug interdiction and law enforcement might decrease,
which Friedman emphasized,
these savings could be offset or perhaps even outweighed by the increased costs related to addiction treatment, public health initiatives, and potentially a rise in other forms of crime associated with increased drug use.
So Bennett essentially paints a picture where the potential societal and healthcare costs resulting from increased drug use could negate any financial benefits gained from reduced law enforcement spending. It's kind of a wash, maybe worse.
Yeah, that's his view. Now, shifting gears slightly, we also have the perspective of Nadelman, who brings a different set of arguments in favor of legalization.
Okay, Nadelman.
Yes. Nadelman is quite critical of our current approach to drug control, arguing that decades of interdiction efforts have been largely ineffective. Essentially a lost cause, he calls it.
A lost cause. Yeah. Strong words.
When it comes to actually controlling the flow of drugs and reducing drug abuse.
Nadelman's central thesis, then, is that despite the enormous resources poured into prohibition over the years, the illegal drug trade continues to flourish, suggesting a fundamental flaw in the underlying strategy. The supply seems almost impossible to completely cut off.
And because he views the current approach as largely a failure, he argues that a policy of legalization and strict regulation is a much more sensible way forward.
Okay.
One that would ultimately save money and allow for better control over the substances themselves. He points to the simple fact that substances like marijuana and opium can be cultivated relatively easily in many different parts of the world, making complete eradication an unrealistic goal.
That really highlights the significant challenges on the supply side of drug prohibition, doesn't it? The ease of production for many of these substances makes it incredibly difficult to effectively control their availability through law enforcement alone.
Nadelman also raises a significant ethical point, suggesting that current anti-drug law enforcement practices often end up causing more harm to individual drug users than to the large-scale drug traffickers who are, you know, the intended targets.
His argument here is that focusing on users can lead to a large number of arrests for possession, resulting in criminal records and incarceration that can have long-lasting negative consequences for individuals, potentially far outweighing the harm caused by their drug use itself.
Right. Now, on the other side of the argument, again, James Q. Wilson reinforces some of the concerns raised by Bennett, particularly the idea that legalization, and especially a significant reduction in drug prices, he even uses a hypothetical example of like a 95% price cut, would inevitably lead to a dramatic explosion of drug abuse.
An explosion. Wilson is emphasizing the concept of price elasticity of demand here. In simple terms, if the price of something drops drastically, the demand for it is likely to increase significantly.
Makes sense.
His concern is that making drugs much cheaper would lead many more people to try them, and consequently, a higher number would likely become addicted.
And Wilson adds a really crucial point about the broader societal impact, arguing that drug abuse is far from a victimless crime.
The ripple effects.
Exactly. He stresses the immense suffering that can be endured by the children, spouses, and other family members of individuals struggling with addiction, something that he feels is often overlooked in discussions that focus primarily on individual liberty and personal choice.
This shifts the focus from the individual user to the wider social consequences of drug addiction, highlighting the ripple effects on families, communities, and the healthcare system.
Now, this is where it takes a really interesting turn. We have a Christian ethicist, Tim Shao, who presents a rather unique and, well, thought-provoking argument against marijuana legalization. And he does so from within a libertarian framework, which is a somewhat unexpected position.
Right, because usually libertarians are for legalization, generally.
Generally, yes. Libertarianism typically advocates for the legalization of marijuana as a means of maximizing individual freedom, with the role of government limited to preventing harm to others, not to protecting individuals from themselves.
So Shao's argument is indeed quite novel. He essentially contends that using the concept of liberty to justify marijuana legalization is, in fact, self-defeating. How so?
His central argument is that marijuana use impairs an individual's ability to think coherently.
Okay.
And he posits that the state actually has a legitimate interest in restricting the use of substances that undermine the very conditions necessary for rational and coherent thought.
This is a fascinating move philosophically. Shao isn't relying on traditional religious or moral arguments against drug use. Instead, he's framing his opposition in terms of the fundamental requirements for the exercise of individual liberty itself.
Okay, let's break down Shao's full line of reasoning. His first premise is that a primary responsibility of the state is to protect individual freedom.
Standard libertarian stuff, right?
Right. A starting point most libertarians would agree with.
His second premise is that to effectively exercise one's freedom, one needs to be rational, because genuine personal agency, the ability to make free choices, depends on it. You can't make truly autonomous decisions if your thinking is significantly impaired.
This premise directly links the concept of freedom to cognitive capacity. Shao argues that rationality is the essential foundation upon which meaningful and free choices are built.
His third premise is that rational thought requires proper cognitive function. Seems pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
And his fourth premise is that marijuana use demonstrably disrupts cognitive function and undermines rational thought. Therefore, and this is his conclusion, the state has a responsibility to restrict marijuana use in order to protect the very possibility of individual freedom.
Wow. So Shao essentially inverts the typical libertarian argument. Instead of asserting that the state shouldn't interfere with marijuana use because it's a private matter of individual choice, he argues that the state must interfere to safeguard the individual's capacity for making those free choices in the first place.
Exactly. Now, he addresses a key libertarian objection head on. The argument that the state is only justified in intervening to prevent coercion or harm inflicted by third parties, and that marijuana use is a self-regarding act that doesn't directly harm others.
Right, the non-aggression principle, essentially.
Shao's response to this is quite provocative. He argues that the intoxicating substance itself acts as a threatening third party, leading to what he terms cognitive slavery, a state where one's own mind is effectively controlled by the drug.
Cognitive slavery. That's a powerful and perhaps controversial analogy. He's suggesting that the drug can enslave the individual's cognitive abilities, thereby diminishing their autonomy, even if the initial decision to use the drug was voluntary.
He even draws a parallel to the libertarian stance against selling oneself into slavery. While a person might seemingly make a free choice to enter into slavery, libertarians generally oppose it because it fundamentally negates all future autonomy.
Right, it violates future liberty.
Shao makes a similar argument regarding suicide, a seemingly free act that, by definition, eliminates all future freedom.
By drawing these analogies, Shao is arguing that marijuana use, due to its impact on cognitive function, has a similar self-undermining effect on the individual's capacity for free agency and future choices. It's quite a line of thought.
It is. Another common objection Shao tackles is the idea that his reasoning could be extended to justify banning things like unhealthy foods.
A slippery slope argument, yeah.
Right. If the state should restrict substances that impair our proper function, shouldn't it also regulate or ban things like excessively fatty or sugary foods? Shao's response is that while unhealthy foods can have negative long-term effects on health and potentially indirect effects on cognitive function, they don't directly and immediately diminish one's ability to think or reason properly in the way he argues marijuana does. He contends that the primary purpose of marijuana is precisely to alter and impair cognition.
So he's drawing a distinction between substances that have indirect cumulative effects over time and a substance whose primary and intended effect is the immediate alteration of one's cognitive state. It's about the directness and purpose of the impairment.
Then there's the argument that if the state can restrict drugs based on their cognitive effects, why not also outlaw certain ideas or ideologies that some might argue undermine rational thought or lead to irrational behavior?
That's a tricky one.
Shao's response here is that the state's legitimate interest lies in protecting the conditions necessary for the liberty of choosing one's beliefs, the capacity for rational thought, not in dictating or controlling the content of those beliefs themselves.
Yeah. Okay, so he's essentially safeguarding freedom of thought and expression, even if those thoughts are, in his view, misguided or illogical. The state's role, according to Shao, is to ensure we have the mental capacity to think freely, not to police the conclusions we reach.
And finally, a big question for many. Why doesn't Shao's logic also lead to a call for banning alcohol?
Yeah, the alcohol comparison seems inevitable.
He argues that alcohol, unlike marijuana in his view, can often be used for purposes other than just intoxication as a social lubricant, or even, for some, to enhance thoughtful discussion in moderation.
Mm.
He also brings up the aesthetic and cultural value associated with alcohol, you know, the appreciation of fine wines and beers in relation to cuisine, contrasting that with marijuana, where he contends the primary and perhaps sole purpose is simply to achieve a state of being high.
This is a point in his argument that might be more open to debate, I think. Many would argue that marijuana also has social uses, and that the line between responsible use and problematic use exists for both alcohol and marijuana. However, Shao's focus remains on what he perceives as the primary intended effect of each substance.
He does briefly address the issue of medical marijuana, acknowledging that prescribing it for legitimate medical needs is appropriate, but he emphasizes that it should be regulated strictly, just like any other pharmaceutical medicine.
Okay.
He also suggests that the actual medical necessity for marijuana might be less prevalent than is sometimes portrayed.
So his position isn't a blanket prohibition on all marijuana use, but rather a very specific argument against its recreational legalization based on its perceived impact on cognitive function and consequently individual liberty. Really interesting angle.
It really is. Now, our source material also includes some additional observations on the morality of drug use, specifically focusing on marijuana from a Christian theological perspective.
Okay. Moving beyond the purely philosophical or economic.
Right. One point that's raised is the concept of the body as a temple of the Holy Spirit, referencing Nancy Piercy's book, Love Thy Body. The underlying idea is that showing respect for one's physical body through things like diet, exercise, and avoiding harmful substances like drugs is seen as a way of honoring God.
This introduces a spiritual and moral dimension to the discussion, where the care and stewardship of one's physical being are viewed as a reflection of one's relationship with the divine.
Another interesting observation brought up is the problem of sloth that is sometimes associated with chronic marijuana use. This is presented as a more personal observation, noting a perceived lack of drive, creativity, and engagement in productive activities among individuals who are regular users.
Hmm. Sloth.
The example of Paul McCartney is mentioned with a somewhat critical perspective offered on his later musical work during periods of marijuana use.
Well, that's certainly more anecdotal line of reasoning, and it's important to acknowledge that individual experiences and creative processes can vary greatly. You know, correlation isn't causation. However, It does raise questions about the potential impact of long-term heavy marijuana use on motivation and overall life engagement for some individuals.
There's also the argument made that drug use can foster a degree of narcissism, a preoccupation with one's own altered mental state, and a tendency towards self-absorption.
This perspective suggests that the introspective and often self-focused nature of the drug experience can, for some individuals, lead to a detachment from broader social responsibilities and relationships, kind of turning inward.
Yeah. And then there's the concern about lawlessness. Even in the context of legal marijuana, the argument suggests that the routine breaking of drug laws in the past...
When it was illegal,
yeah, can potentially dull one's conscience and make it easier to engage in other illegal behaviors. A personal anecdote is shared about a past instance of petty theft using the metaphor of a cut loaf of bread. Yeah, the idea being that once you've broken one law, the barrier to breaking others can be weakened. Like taking the first slice makes the next one easier.
I see. That suggests that engaging in any form of illegal activity, even if it seems minor at the time, can have a broader impact on one's moral framework and propensity to follow rules.
Finally, there's the issue of bad company. The argument here is that involvement in illegal drug activities can often lead to associations with dangerous individuals and precarious situations.
Makes sense given the black market context.
Again, illustrated by a personal anecdote about a tense encounter with someone higher up in a drug distribution network.
This underscores the very real risks associated with the criminal element that often surrounds the illegal drug trade. And it suggests that even casual users can find themselves in potentially harmful situations just by association.
So as we've explored in this deep dive, the debate surrounding drug legalization is incredibly multifaceted. We've examined economic arguments concerning narco-terrorism and potential financial savings, societal anxieties about increased drug abuse and crime rates, intricate ethical considerations around individual liberty and the capacity for rational thought, and even theological viewpoints on the morality of drug use. It's a lot.
It really is. And it's important to reiterate for you that our aim throughout this discussion has been to thoroughly examine these diverse perspectives as they are presented in the source materials you provided. Without advocating for any particular stance ourselves, we're just unpacking the arguments.
Exactly. And that leads us to a final point for you to consider. Reflecting on the various arguments we've unpacked today, you know, the tension between personal liberty and potential societal costs, the different views on the effectiveness of prohibition versus regulation, where do you see the most compelling arguments for or against different levels of drug legalization? And what role do you believe the state should ideally play in regulating substances that have the potential to impact both individual well-being and the broader collective? It's a complex web of issues to consider.
Indeed. It's a discussion that really forces us to weigh competing values and analyze potential consequences at multiple levels of society. No easy answers, like we said at the start.
Absolutely not. Thanks so much for taking this deep dive with us. We hope it's given you a lot to think about.